What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back to talk snakes. It's Snake Talk.
That's right. We're continuing this month's movie episode, announce episodes, because you got to pick the movie this time. You picked Conan the Barbarian.
Hadn't seen it in a while. Was wondering how it held up. And, you know, it kind of did. It kind of didn't. But it's definitely worth talking about.
But one of the key centerpieces in this film is the cult of Set, Thulsa Doom's religion. I mean, he seems into the branding even in the earlier portions of the film when he's just a warrior.
Yeah, that's a little confusing because the whole thing is that, like, James Earl Jones, he was like, once I was a young man and I was just a warlord running around raiding villages. You know, the sorry I killed your parents. Not that sorry.
Yeah, I don't think he ever said he was sorry.
No, he didn't say he was sorry. No, in fact, he says to Conan, he's like, got Arnold Schwarzenegger on the floor. He's like, when I destroyed your village, I made you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, pretty much. But then later in the film, he's like, oh, I don't do that anymore. Now I'm just a regular cult leader. But in both cases, he's carrying the symbol of his cult, even though he's not a cult leader yet in the earlier part. And the symbol of his cult, which is referred to in the movie as the Cult of Set or the Temple of Set. And in the last episode, we discussed the real ancient Egyptian – well, maybe not real, but the real mythology of the ancient Egyptian god Set or Seth and how he is very different than the Set represented in the film. But the cult of Set in the film has the symbol of the two-headed snake with the two heads facing off against each other.
Right. I mean, maybe part of it is that just even though his approach to life changed a little bit, he just always had great branding.
He always loved snakes.
Yeah, or certainly he just maybe just took up the emblem at some point. And there was a pre-existing cult of Set. I mean, certainly that would – if you're creating a cult leader, I mean, some cult leaders create their faith wholesale from new parts, but for the most part, they're depending on something that came before and just inserting themselves into it.
That's exactly right. I mean, in fact, I can scarcely think of a cult that doesn't draw on some existing mythology. I mean, you think about the Heaven's Gate cult. I mean, that was in a large part based on like UFO mythology and existing Christianity. Mm-hmm. Even if you look at like the Raelians or Raelians, one of the UFO religions, the guy who founded it has this whole book going through like the books of the Bible and all this, talking about how it's actually all about alien encounters and alien technology. It's basically an ancient aliens religion.
Yeah. So the emblem for the Temple of Set in this film, he has this really cool logo, actually, that it's like there are two different versions of it. You kind of see one is like on the staffs and the armor that they carry, and then there's this like simplified logo. But it's a snake with two heads, a head on each end. Like the head of the snake is a snake head, and the tail of the snake is a snake head.
Yes.
And they're rising against each other, and in the background there is a sun.
And in fact, it's a plot point in the film because Conan and his friends go around looking for Thulsa Doom, played by James Earl Jones, by asking about this symbol. It's like, have you seen this symbol anywhere? That's how they initially connect with him.
So it should come as a surprise to nobody that the idea of a snake with a head on each end predates this film.
Uh-huh.
This is something that that we can go back in time and we can find examples of in the human use of symbols.
Right. Now you might be thinking about other existing snake symbols that are a little bit different. You might be thinking about the Ouroboros,
right,
where a snake is swallowing its own tail, but that's different than two snake heads facing each other.
Right. Though, I mean, in the Ouroboros' defense, we usually don't see the tail because it's in his mouth. Who's to say there wasn't a head on there? But yeah, the Ouroboros, the World Serpent, the Midgard Sorm, it is depicted as this snake consuming itself.
On the other hand, one that is very similar but isn't quite the same thing, does have snake heads facing each other, would be the Caduceus.
Mm-hmm. This is like the staff with the snakes.
Yeah,
coming
the staff of Hermes, yeah.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is the Amphisbaena, and it's a name that's derived from the Greek to go both ways,
mm-hmm,
because of the idea is that it's a snake that can move forwards or backwards with ease.
The one thing I've read is that snakes that just have one normal head and a normal tail can sometimes slither backwards. Like I was reading a book about how the author observed that coral snakes seem to be able to slither backwards just fine.
Right. And so, I mean, of course, in all of this, we're dealing with something. On one level, there's the symbolism level of it, right? Like, what does the idea of a snake with two heads mean? How does it function in the human mind? But then also, there is a certain degree of just like weird tales about what snakes look like. So according to Carol Rose, the folklorist whose books I always come back to, she has a nice write-up about it in one of her monster books. And she points out that the Greek writer Lucan described it as a desert creature of North Africa. And of course, as we'll see, Pliny the Elder, of course, also wrote about it.
Okay.
But I also was reading from a 1996 article, Stalking the Amphisbaena by Sidney J. Levy from the Journal of Consumer Research.
What?
That mentions that this particular symbol, quote, was probably intended to express the horror and anguish associated with ambivalent situations.
Oh, yeah. It certainly goes with the kind of classic archetype of psychodynamics, right? The idea that like this might not be the most correct way of thinking about the mind now. But if you go back to Freudian thought, you know, mm-hmm, he often seemed to emphasize that major problems in the mind, the psychoses and things, were caused by states of ambivalence where you had, you know, conflicting desires or conflicting tendencies that couldn't be resolved.
Yeah. Should I stay or should I go? I don't know. I'm of two snakes on the matter. So this particular beast also shows up in a lot of medieval bestiaries as a winged creature with two legs added as well. Sometimes it's said that it can roll like a hoop snake being kind of a form of an Ouroboros that's less concerned with what happens if a snake consumes itself. How's this play out in my mind versus what if a snake just bit its own tail and then rolled like a wheel down a hill?
Now, this is a mythical creature, a real creature, though there is a real wheel spider.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some real rolling creatures, but not quite like a hoop snake. here's what Pliny had to say about the Amphisbaena in The Natural History.
Glad Pliny was on it.
The Amphisbaena has a twin head, that is one at the tail end as well, as though it were not enough for poison to be poured out of one mouth. because that's another aspect of it is that the creature is supposed to be, like any mythic serpent, it's highly venomous. Mm-hmm. And so maybe the idea is it's just so venomous that one head's not enough. It needs two heads for all that venom. Then likewise, there are accounts of how you can use its dried skin to, say, treat rheumatism. So there's, you know, there are all these different stories about it. And it reminds me a lot of the of some of the things we were discussing about the basilisk.
Okay.
Now, Rose writes that while exaggerated, she thinks it was likely based on some real venomous reptile in the Libyan desert, perhaps one that was capable of slithering in either direction, which, as you said, that's not—
Some real snakes can do.
Not that impressive, but if you didn't know that, it's kind of like if you don't know that horses can lay down and then you see one laying down, sleeping, and you're like, whoa, and then you start reporting, you're going to call up Pliny immediately, right, and tell him. Or the other possibility is that it's a snake that seemed to raise its tail like a head when it was threatened. And we'll come back to that because there are some potential examples of that for sure. Then there are, you know, if we look outside of Western traditions, we also see double-headed serpents in the Aztec tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah, with a you know, there's a particularly interesting 15th or 16th century turquoise example that I'm sure everyone's seen photos of. There's a particularly nice example of this in the British Museum. This turquoise serpent creature with this like almost bear-like head on either end. And it's uncertain exactly what it's depicting. So, you know, the idea may be that this is just representing that serpentine rebirth that we've talked about. So this is not so much a snake with two heads, mm-hmm. but that it's a snake emerging from itself, from its skin. It also may well be related to Quetzalcoatl, which we did an episode on talking about the importance of the plumed serpent in Mesoamerican religion. And we should also point out that that particular god, there's a snake god that is certainly far removed from anything Thulsa Doom represents.
No, thoroughly non-doomy.
And then I also read that it's possible that this is not like clearly maybe an Aztec creation, but maybe it's a creation of the Mixtec people. So you're ultimately going with perhaps several different degrees of separation between the people who originally dreamed up and created this work of art versus those certainly who now possess it.
So obviously the next question is, are there two-headed snakes in real life?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the answer is clearly yes. Two-headed snakes of a certain kind, I will say, absolutely do exist and are pretty regularly captured or bred in captivity. It seems like maybe once every couple of years, herpetologists come across one new and interesting case of this that blows up in the media. I think they probably get discovered more often. It's just only sometimes do they really catch fire on the internet. But yes, there are pretty frequently cases of two-headed snakes known as dicephalic or polycephalic, meaning, you know, two heads or many heads, from species like ladder snakes, copperheads, king snakes, I've read about in all those species and others. And these snakes generally have two heads, both growing from the neck end of the body. There is no species of snake that is regularly like this. Rather, this is not an adaptation or evolutionary change. It's a developmental anomaly. It occurs the same way that most other conjoined twins do when an embryo in utero splits into twins, but it doesn't split all the way, leading to embryos that continue to develop while remaining attached in some way.
That's right. And if you want some more information on conjoined twins, we actually discussed this in our Halloween episode, one of our Halloween episodes last year, the Tales from the Crypt episode. Because of course there's a Tales from the Crypt episode. There's more than one actually
that in an insensitive manner. But
so
yeah.
So we use that episode as an excuse to like, all right, let's put aside the trash, and because let's face it, Tales from the Crypt is ultimately a trashy show. Mm-hmm. But let's set all that aside and discuss like, you know, what the actual science is.
Yeah.
And so we went through all the various forms that occur.
And so, yeah, this occurs in all kinds of animals. And in the cases I've read about, what happens with snakes is you've got two heads that are side by side, both extending from the neck at different sometimes there will be different amounts of like length of the body that are separated. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the heads are very close to each other. Sometimes they've got significant amounts of separate neck. But they share connections usually to the top of the alimentary canal. But the question would be here, what about a snake with a head on both ends of the length of the body, like in Thulsa Doom's standard for the Cult of Set? Could there be a snake that's got a head for a tail?
Well, we already mentioned that Pliny the Elder discussed one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't have Pliny with us any longer, but we do have the Daily Mail.
Oh.
and so I was looking around, you know, for doing various searches for two-headed snakes, and I found an article from September 23rd, 2012, by Daily Mail reporter titled, "They Both Seem to Control It. Family Finds Snake with Two Heads, One on Each End of Its Body."
Okay.
And so this all seemed to have happened in South Carolina, and it was originally reported by Fox Carolina, presumably its Fantastic Beasts news beat, news desk. And it was identified by the local high school's biology department as a rough earth snake. And you look at these pictures, they're not, you know, super clear, but—
There was video.
There was video at some point, but the video, I couldn't find actual
footage. Oh, I watched the video.
You watched the video?
I'll talk about it in a second.
All right, good, because the video footage I found had been removed, as had the, like I was getting a 404 on the original Fox reporting. But the article was pretty fun. My favorite line from it was, quote, "But while the snake pulls itself in opposite directions, young Savannah and Preston are also pulled in different directions on what to name the snake."
That's right. One of them wanted to name it Billy Bob.
Yeah, and the other said Oreo.
Right. yeah, I was looking for more on this story to try to dig underneath, like, the Daily Mail article, and I couldn't get under it.
I don't understand why there wasn't more follow-up. I mean, I suspect it's because the snake died and everyone was like, oh, well, now I'm sad and let's move on with it. But
Or because the original reporting might have been mistaken.
That's the other – yeah, we don't know ultimately.
Yeah. So even though there's video – I mean, I did watch video, and it's a small snake, but they've got it in, like, a little igloo cooler, and it's slithering around, and it has some kind of – it wasn't super high definition, but it's got something on its tail that looks sort of head-shaped.
Right.
Even though I saw some video, I'm still a little bit skeptical. I wonder if what's being interpreted as a head on the tail end of the snake is not really a head.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge possibility.
So just to as backup for that, as that being a possibility, I was looking at a book from JHU Press 2018 called American Snakes by Sean P. Graham. And just as a side note, before we get to the thing that I went to this book for, as a side note, there's a part I found where the author is describing strange defense strategies that snakes employ. And this unrelated one is called cloacal popping.
Oh, okay.
So sometimes – have you read about this?
No. I mean, if you'd asked me what cloacal popping was, I would assume it's like the hottest new dance. number that I'm not familiar with.
So sometimes when threatened, some types of snakes will rapidly turn their cloaca inside out. The cloaca is the common hole at the rear of the body that's used for urinary tract, digestive tract, and reproductive tract. So it's a common sort of hole back there that takes care of all the comings and goings at the backside of the body. So when these snakes get captured or handled or encounter some kind of menace, they will sort of suddenly vigorously poop out part of their own rectum, basically. It's not a rectum, it's a cloaca, which produces these popping or squishing sounds, which are vaguely audible to us. It's not known what adaptive purpose, if any, this has. But there's your fact of the day, cloacal popping.
Okay, a little extra there.
Okay. But also, the reason I was reading about this is that I was looking for examples, and this is absolutely true, that some snake species have a defensive strategy that's known as automimicry, which involves having a tail that looks like a second head. And examples of this include the rubber boa, which can use its tail as a decoy head if it's attacked. Like if this snake is attacked, if you've seen pictures of the rubber boa, you might have seen it not just coiled but sort of tied up in itself like a knot. It'll, you know, be a jumble. Mm-hmm. And while it's in this tangle, it will raise its tail up as if it were raising its head up and allow whatever is attacking it to attack its tail while it, you know, the real head is defended under the coiled body and perhaps searching for an escape route.
Right. And so in this, it has a lot in common with various other animals where the idea is if a predator is going to attack you, draw their attack away from the more sensitive parts of your anatomy.
Yes.
Draw them away from like your brain or your torso. Get them towards the tail.
There are some creatures that even practice something that's known as autotomy.
Oh, yes.
Where they will like release their tail sort of as a distraction or a gift to the predator while the rest of them can escape.
Yeah. I encountered this on a nature path over the weekend.
Oh, really?
I was walking with my son, and lo and behold, there in the path is we see a little lizard tail still moving, still flopping back and forth.
Wow.
No sign of its former owner, and so we were trying to decide, well, what happened here? Did the lizard attempt to prevent predation and it didn't work?
Mm-hmm.
Or did it work and all the parties have gone their separate ways? It's a fascinating survival adaptation. I believe there is an episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind in the vault about it.
I think we did a two-parter about tails a long time ago.
Yes. Oh, we talked about the scorpion.
The scorpion autotomy, where its tail will come off, but then it can't live much longer after that because it can't poop.
That's right. The tail or one of the lost segments of the tail contained the scorpion anus.
Yeah.
And therefore, it can never poop again, which, I mean, as far as scorpion timelines go, it's probably not that bad. But that's the world of scorpions. Let's get back to the world of snakes.
Says you. How do you know how bad it is? I speak for the scorpions.
Well, I mean, never having to poop again, I can just imagine, there's going to be some huge downsides to that. But then there are certain upsides, namely not having to poop again.
Okay, so I want to be clear. I want to try to be humble about what's going on with the supposed two-headed head on the tail snake here. I don't know that what's going on here is like a mistaken case of automimicry. I just will say that I'm not yet convinced that this is really a snake with a head on both ends. It seems a little hard for me to imagine exactly how that happens. Like, where is the cloaca, for one thing? Is it in the middle of the snake? Will the two heads go out from each side? All the snakes where we have confirmed accounts that like are really well documented that I could find are where the heads appear at the same end. And so I'm skeptical about this. I am not yet convinced that this is for real.
Yeah, I definitely would love to see more evidence, be it just visual evidence of this particular snake or just more people saying, I would love to hear from the actual science teacher who presumably weighed in on this.
Oh, yeah. If you've seen this thing up close and you're listening now, get in touch.
Yeah. And likewise, I feel like the town that this occurred in, like this should be, if this was real, this snake should be like the mascot for the city at this point.
Right.
But anyway, to get back to the broader subject of polycephaly or having two heads in the serpent world.
Mm-hmm.
It's rare, but it does seem to occur. It seems to occur more in the snake world.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard to say for sure because such specimens, they tend to die fast in the wild.
Yeah, I've seen it speculated but not known for sure that it happens more often in snakes in captivity than it does in wild snakes. But that's not something that's known. It's just kind of a possibility.
I found a 2012 paper in the Bulletin of the Chicago Herpetological Society titled Two-Headed Snakes Make High-Maintenance Pets by Van Wallach. And the author points out that there was a 1937 book by an individual by the name of Cunningham on the subject of two-headed snakes. And that book cataloged 950 cases in 169 species from 94 genera. And the author here writes that currently, and this is 2012 currently, there were 1,350 known cases, 191 species in 103 genera. And Van Wallach drove home that most of them end up just drowning in the egg, or they're stillborn, or they die shortly after birth. But if they do survive, one of the things is, and this is the key to the title of the paper, they're difficult to care for.
Yeah,
they require extra assistance in eating. They need extra assistance even when they shed their skin. But they can survive in captivity in some cases.
Yeah, but they do encounter all kinds of problems to survival. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are good reasons you don't usually come across them alive in the wild. For one thing, with two heads, movement is a lot more difficult. You know, you got two brains that can struggle for control of the body. Feeding can be more difficult as the two heads sometimes fight each other over access to the food. Also, in some cases, after, of course, predation can be more difficult. And then in some cases, after feeding, I was reading that if one of the snake's heads smells like prey because it just ate, the other head may sometimes mistake that head for prey and try to attack it.
And then we're potentially back in Ouroboros country at that point.
Yeah. And another thing that I thought was kind of morbidly interesting in the Van Wallica piece that you just mentioned, there is a risk, for example, if you've got a snake in a two-headed snake in a tank, a risk of the snake crawling into apertures or past obstacles, because of course snakes very often like to hide inside holes and enclosures. But if they have two heads bifurcated at the neck, you can run into a situation where one head is trying to pass by an obstacle or go into a hole that's essentially like smashing the other head against that aperture or that obstacle, trying to get past it, and could end up sort of peeling the other head off as it struggles to go forward.
That's not good. That's not good for anybody.
And the snakes are not, I mean, they don't have a lot of complex cognition. They can't usually think, oh, I should back up. You know, it just doesn't seem to occur to them.
Now, outside of the world of snakes, we should also note that real life worm lizards are also known as amphisbaena. But they, of course, only have one head. But their tail does truncate in a way that kind of resembles a head.
So is it a form of auto-mimicry, they think?
I'm not entirely sure on that. If it actually functions as a mimic head, or it's just one of these things where we look at it and we say, oh, well, the end kind of looks like a head, and then they decided to bestow this name upon them.
Okay, I think we got to take a break, but we will be right back with more.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Okay, so we're thinking about Thulsa Doom in the Conan the Barbarian movie. One thing that the great Thulsa Doom does, one trick he's got up his sleeve, is the snake arrow.
Yes. So this is one of my favorite snake tricks from the film.
Uh-huh.
And there are a couple of scenes where he employs this, one extremely dramatically, where he'll draw a venomous snake, mm-hmm. and then he'll stretch it out and he'll make it rigid like an arrow. And then he will take the rigid snake and he will put it in a bow and then he will fire it as an arrow at one of his enemies.
Right.
And so he takes a venomous snake and uses it as a venomous arrow.
Yeah. This is how he kills Conan's beloved, the thief Valyria.
Yes. So if you're watching this, you're not asking questions, but I can't help but wonder, well, where does this come from? Like, they had to have been inspired by this, and even if they weren't inspired by a particular detail from history or mythology, then clearly they weren't the ones to think of it first. Somebody else came up with this cool idea earlier.
Uh-huh.
And indeed, we do see some form of this in the Hindu epic, the Ramayana.
Oh, okay.
So there are mentions in the Ramayana of serpent arrows or Sharpavana. And then there's also the Nagapasha, a powerful snake-turned arrow created by Brahma. So one particular character, we have the Prince of Lanka, and this is the son of the ten-headed Ravana. Ravana being
like a demon.
Yeah, he's like the demon king, principal antagonist in this particular Hindu epic.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the Prince of Lanka is named Indrajit, and he employs a host of wondrous weapons, including serpent arrows. And I could have this wrong, but it seems like the descriptions vary as to whether these are snakes transformed into arrows or snakes fired as arrows. Again, I don't know, you know, at what point you draw a line between these two things.
Uh-huh.
Also, I'm left wondering if they're venomous, like those that Thulsa Doom uses, or do they coil around the victim?
Oh.
Now, the later would seem to be the case based on some of the depictions I've seen of Hanuman, the monkey, bound up by such an arrow.
Oh, okay. And so it'd almost be something more like a bolus or something, like it binds the enemy, you shoot it at them and it wraps them up.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be what's taking place in some of these illustrations I was looking at. Like, you've been shot by a snake and now you're wrapped up in the snake. Now, of course, that's, again, we've gone from Hollywood film to Hindu mythology, but let's bring it back to history.
Okay.
So what about just snake venom arrows? Not a snake, like we're not even going to explore, we're not going to even attempt to myth bust the idea that you could that you could string a snake in a bow and arrow and fire it at somebody. That's not going
to
work.
I don't think that would work. I don't think you could get the snake to stay rigid for that. But I do think there have been cases where snakes have been used, you know, intact as bioweapons, you know, just sort of like seeding enemy territory with poisonous snakes.
Yeah. And certainly the idea of using snake venom on an arrow, this does seem to be a thing. I was looking at a paper titled Chemical and Biological Warfare in Antiquity from 2015 by Stanford's Adrian Mayer.
Oh, yeah, of the geomythology episode. Yeah.
And this was in History of Toxicology and Environmental Health.
All right.
So some of the points that Mayer makes. First of all, snake venom is digestible, so it's actually suitable for killing game.
Oh, that's interesting. So, like, you can eat it without it necessarily harming you.
Right, yeah, or you don't have to worry about, yeah, I've felled a deer, and now I can potentially eat this deer. I haven't, like, you know, ruined the deer.
Mm-hmm.
Another point they make is that in warfare, the venom can produce agonizing pain and or a never-healing wound.
Hmm.
And then there are numerous venomous snakes in the Mediterranean and in Africa and Asia that one could turn to. And the Greeks and Romans recorded numerous groups that were known to utilize their venom on arrows. Greek geographer Strabo, she writes, wrote of Ethiopian arrows dipped in, quote, the gall of serpents, and that the Soans of the Caucasus used arrow poison so noxious that the smell alone was supposed to injure you. And then poisonous arrows, though perhaps not snake-based, pop up in ancient China and South America as well. We'll come back to China in a second.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big one. Snake venom crystallizes, so it can cling and remain viable on wooden, bone, and metal points.
Okay, so it wouldn't just be like dipping it in water that would run off.
Right, yeah, and fly off as you send the arrow sailing, like it would have some sticking potential there. Also, the Greeks wrote of the deadly arrows of the Scythians coated in Scythicon, which was said to be a combination of venom and various other infectious agents like dung and human blood.
Gross.
Yeah, and this comes back to something we'll see in the Chinese example of like people potentially just taking a bunch of things that were known or suspected to be nasty and infectious mm-hmm. and combining them together
yeah.
and then using that as a coating for a weapon.
Yeah, so the it might be that there were some vague concepts about biowarfare in the ancient world or, before we had a germ theory of disease, say, or modern theories of toxicology and biology and chemistry. But still, they would have some vague ideas that there's a bunch of stuff you just group under poison.
Right.
And that's things that will poison you in the direct chemical sense or cause infections.
Exactly. Mayer also points out that several venomous snakes would have been at the disposal of the Scythians, so the Caucasus viper, the European adder, and the sand viper. Alexander the Great, according to his campaign historians, encountered snake venom weapons in the conquest of India, specifically in Harmatilia in modern-day Pakistan. Quote, any man who suffered even a slight wound felt immediately numb and experienced stabbing pains and convulsions. The victim's skin became pale and cold, and he vomited bile. Soon, a black froth exuded from the wound. Purplish-green gangrene spread rapidly, followed by death. So the idea was, well, perhaps this was cobra venom, but and that was long the theory, she points out, but that the counter to that is that cobra venom brings on a largely painless death due to respiratory paralysis. So it's likely that it was another species of venomous snake that was utilized there. Now, on the subject of snake venom in Chinese weapons, Christian and I did an episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind years ago titled Six Deadly Venoms, where we discussed various venoms from history and what their biological component was.
Uh-huh.
And we discussed the Chinese poison gu and what it might have actually been with all of the folklore and superstition removed. The idea being that this was – gu was supposed to be a poison that was used by sort of rival ethnic groups on the border.
Hmm.
And so
doesn't the idea of goo also has connotations of like decay or something?
It yeah, well there are kind of two different it kind of becomes a complex topic because it's you can sort of view it as being a poison that was utilized by a foreign adversary, mm-hmm. or it's kind of like an aspect of their foreignness. It gets kind of complicated, and we certainly give it more of a robust treatment in that episode. But one of the main sources we turned to on that was the Miao and Poison, Interactions on China's Southwest Frontier by Norma Diamond, published in a 1988 edition of Ethnology. And this was said to be a poison used by the Miao people, one of China's 55 ethnic groups, mostly in the mountains of southern China. And the Gu folklore of the Tang Dynasty from around 618 CE onward took a couple of different forms. One was that it was just a quasi-magical poison created by sealing five different poisonous creatures together in a jar and keeping it in a dark place for a year. So you throw in a snake, a centipede, the toad, the scorpion, and the lizard.
Oh, no.
And you just let them duke it out in there until there's only one survivor, and then that survivor dies. And then when you open up the jar, bam, you got some poison.
It's like the doomsday of poison.
Yeah. But in terms of figuring out what the actual poison might be, like if there's a real poison that was utilized by this group of people, you have to ask, well, what was it really? Where were they getting it? They weren't really creating a magical poison. But if we set aside all these supernatural ideas, there are various theories that arise, but one of them is that there were poisons that were used in hunting by the Miao. There is the sap of a particular tree, but also sometimes they would mix this sap with snake venom, and it was widely traded in the area around Nanning. So this is a case where it doesn't sound like they definitely depended on snake venom, but snake venom might have been part of the cocktail. And then we, of course, have to wonder, like, to what extent it was an active part of the cocktail, if it was really more about the herbal ingredients and the tree sap that was utilized as opposed to the strength of the snake venom. This would be an interesting topic to come back to because, of course, one's reminded of to branch over into the amphibian world, mm-hmm. the various poison dart frogs. And their high toxicity, mm-hmm. but of course the fact of the matter with these species is that if you go and see them at like your local botanical garden or zoo, they're not actually going to be poisonous there because they don't have access to the vegetation that they consume to give them that high degree of toxicity.
Oh yeah, I mean a lot of extremely poisonous or extremely venomous animals get their potency from something in their natural ecology, often from like a bacterium or something. It's from their microbiome or something else that they consume.
But anyway, to bring it all back to old Thulsa Doom, venomous arrows, definitely a thing. Shooting actual snakes at people, not a thing unless you were a mythological figure.
You know, there are many animals mentioned in the Bible that actually we don't know exactly how to translate them. Like modern scholars aren't sure what this name of an animal refers to. And one of them that's often been kind of confusing is this animal that's mentioned called the arrow snake.
Oh.
So that's how the name of it is translated. But I never made the connection. I don't know if that means that there's some suggestion that it's a snake that would have had venom used in arrows. I kind of doubt it, but that's a possibility.
I mean, you're also left with just the undeniable comparison between an arrow, which is a very old bit of human technology, and the naturally occurring snake. Like the snake can be stretched out and it looks kind of like an arrow.
Mm-hmm.
The comparison is unavoidable, both in understanding what an arrow is and understanding what a snake is.
Yeah, they're both considered deadly.
Yes.
Even though most snakes, not deadly. We don't want to contribute to snake panic on here. Snakes are great.
Yeah.
You want snakes living around your house. You want them.
And in fact, I would love to come back to that. I've already sort of planted the seeds. We'll see. But I'm thinking about having a guest come back on the show and discuss the importance of snakes in our local habitats.
I am so on board for that. I want to do whatever we can to fight reptile hate.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we will discuss one more aspect of Thulsa Doom's cult and how it compares to the natural world.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. All right, we're back.
So clearly the best thing about the Conan the Barbarian movie, as we've discussed before, is James Earl Jones in the role of Thulsa Doom. But he does one thing in the movie that we haven't gotten to yet. I don't think we've mentioned, which is that he can turn himself into a giant snake.
Oh, yes. He does this. He changes into a giant snake in order to escape the vengeance of Conan.
Yeah. There's also a part where Conan just goes into a tower and kills a giant snake for no good reason, except I guess he wanted to steal and... the snake woke up while he was stealing.
Well, the snake was a pet was it Rexor had raised? Which one was it?
I think it was Thorgrim. The one played by Sven Ole Thorsen.
Yes, yes.
Secundus from Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe.
Yes, him. So he had raised this snake from a child. It lived in the temple. It was the pet of Thulsa Doom. Uh-huh. So, but it was also like the security device. And Conan and his compatriots had broken into the temple to steal things.
Is just one of the many examples in the movie where you see Conan like enacting brutal violence on something where you kind of take the other thing's side. It's like, I'd kind of like to see the snake win here. You know, Conan's just chopping its head off. I'm trying to steal a gem. Won't you leave me alone?
Yeah, and certainly Conan does succeed in massacring this giant, beautiful reptile.
Yeah. But also James Earl Jones can turn himself into a massive giant snake, which is not the same as the earlier snake. There's multiple giant snakes in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of authentically, this is one of the aspects of like old pulp wizards is you don't know what they're capable of. They can pull off any number of of dark sorceries. They have a pet snake. They can turn into a pet snake. They can make snakes and arrows. There's no limit. But it leads to the unavoidable question. Like, how big do terrestrial snakes get? How big have they gotten in the past? Is there anything in the world today as big as the snake we see in the Temple of Set? And if not, was there ever anything that big? So let's start with the present and work our way back.
Okay.
So this is a topic I've looked into previously. Actually, I ended up writing an article about this for How Stuff Works a few years back. And when we discuss the biggest snakes, there are a couple of species that we turn to. And in both cases, we turn to the females because they run larger. So we have the Asian reticulated python, or Python reticulatus, and these tend to be the longest snakes that mm-hmm. you find in the natural world. The most reputable record lengths are around 25 feet or 7.6 meters. Field measurements in a 1999 survey averaged a little under 12 feet or 3.2 meters in the jungles of southern Sumatra, maxing out at just shy of 20 feet or 6.1 meters. Then in South America, we have the green anaconda.
Ah, okay. This would be of the movie Anaconda
yes,
fame.
To bring in another giant snake movie.
Another great cheesy action movie.
Yeah, the one that it ends up eating John Voight for a while.
For a while. Speaking of films I loved when I was younger and mm-hmm. recently went back and revisited, Anaconda's another one.
Yeah?
Yeah, I loved that when I was a kid. I went back and watched it within the past couple of years, and that is a great cheesy creature flick. It is worth a watch.
Now, is the creature in question the giant snake or John Voight? Because he's the villain
of
the piece.
Yes. John Voight in it is also, speaking of like actors who go whole hog, who just like go over the horizon with their villain performances. John Voight's doing it in this movie. He's got this accent that who knows what it's supposed to sound like. He's playing like a South American Dracula who hunts snakes. It's just amazing.
I need to see that one again. So yes, if you go to South America, you'll get the green anaconda. And these tend to be the more massive of the two species here. Larger females typically reach lengths of 9 feet, 2.7 meters, and they weigh upward of 200 pounds or 90.7 kilograms. Up to 29 and 32-foot lengths have been considered possible by experts. So this tends to be, when you get into arguments about what's the largest living snake, you're going to have people that are on team reticulated python, and you're going to have people that are on team green anaconda. Mm-hmm. If you go to a zoo or a reptile house and you happen to see specimens of both species, you could probably make a case for either depending on how large the individual is. And also in either case, there are also wilder stories and even some photo evidence of skins that suggest larger creatures. So it might be just a reported sighting or someone said, look, here's a picture of the skin we got from this snake. The problem in these situations is that snake skins, once they've been removed from the snake, may be stretched out a bit. Not only you can stretch your story and you can stretch your physical evidence, and it becomes harder to lean on it.
Hmm.
But to just give an idea some of the crazier sightings, in 1923, Fritz W. Uptegraff reported seeing a 50 to 60 foot or 15 to 18 meter green anaconda.
Hmm.
And that's one that I've seen the experts, they really kind of roll their eyes at that one. But both of these are cases where those giant snakes, those are impressive creatures. If you get to see them at any kind of a reptile house, or certainly if you ever get to see one in the wild, like that's impressive. But they're not as big as the giant snake we see in Conan the Barbarian. To find something that big, we have to go back in time.
Not to the Hyborian Age.
Yeah. We have to go well past the time of High Adventure. We have to go back 60 million years. Specifically, we have to go to what is now known as the country of Colombia, and we have to go to the Sarajan Rainforest. And that is where we will find the Titanoboa.
Titanoboa.
Yes. And this is a creature that's received a lot of press. Mm-hmm. There's some cool artwork that was created with to go along with the studies about the Titanoboa and the fossil evidence that that informs us about its size. But this was an impressive serpent. This was kind of a very, you know, like a hot box jungle environment, mm-hmm. and that's one of the reasons that this serpent could reach such a size 60 million years ago. The temperatures there, probably an average yearly temperature of 86 to 93 degrees Fahrenheit or 30 to 34 degrees Celsius, far hotter than modern tropical rainforest temperatures. And the size of this creature was impressive. University of Florida paleontologists estimate its tip-to-tail length at a whopping 42 feet or 13 meters, and it would have had a crushing weight of more than a ton.
Wow.
So this particular species, Titanoboa, would definitely be able to stand in for that giant snake we see in Conan the Barbarian.
And don't you lay a finger on it, Conan. Don't you hurt this snake.
It is a wholly blameless creature. It is, you know, whatever your feelings are about Thulsa Doom and his awful death cult, which granted is an awful death cult, you know, we can't blame that on the snake.
Why don't they look? I have a question about snake size and our supposed instincts. Now, we talked a little bit in the last episode about the idea that there's an ongoing debate about the extent to which our the common fear of certain types of animal forms, particularly things like snakes and spiders, is hardwired into human brains. It's a thing that you're born being afraid of without even having been told it exists.
Right.
Or is it a culturally conditioned fear, you know, something we learn about from fiction and from people around us that we're supposed to be afraid of? And there's obviously going to be some cultural conditioning, but the question is there something that's there before that? Is it there in the brain before the culture gets to you? And there's some evidence, I think, that, you know, even like babies looking at pictures of snakes get pupil dilation when they see an image of a snake. But my question would be, does that scale? Like, once you get to a snake of this size, it's so big, it's not even really recognizable as a snake in the way you would normally perceive snake threats. It becomes a dragon. It becomes some kind of completely other thing. I mean, the kind of snakes that would be any sort of normal threat that you might have biological conditioning to avoid would be relatively small snakes. Their threat would be in their venom, not in their size.
Right. But you're saying, like, if we were to encounter a Titanoboa in the wild,
would it even register as a snake to us?
Hmm. Well, I think on one level, you know, yeah, it wouldn't have to. Like, I think there is something. There's that kind of magical moment, like a darkly magical moment, whenever you perceive a predator in the wild, like not just any predator, but a creature that could conceivably prey upon a human. At least a, you know, a weakened human. It feels like it sets off different alarms in your brain, you know?
Yeah.
Like when you lock eyes with that lion, I've certainly been in this situation, when you're the first person to the zoo and the lion sees you, mm-hmm. and you lock eyes with the lion, or perhaps the lion looks at the small child that's traveling with you, uh-huh. And you realize, oh, I would... You know, if not for this glass wall, if not for for the artificial aspects of this encounter, I would be the one fleeing now. I would be the one, you know, at least backing away, if not running in terror. So I feel like that would certainly kick in.
Yeah.
If you were to encounter the Titanoboa.
Yeah, I guess I'm not saying people wouldn't be afraid of it with good reason.
I think they wouldn't say eek is the difference.
Yeah.
They wouldn't say eek a snake. They would say, oh my God. A snake.
But I guess humans and the Titanoboa never existed at the same time.
Right.
So there'd be no reason to have this kind of conditioned fear.
Yeah. I mean, the closest would be, you know, any degree of conditioning that might come from being around, you know, green anacondas and reticulated pythons. But that's a different level of – it's totally not the same thing as the danger of a venomous snake where I could conceivably accidentally – wind up bitten by the snake.
Yeah. I think also a lot of the danger there with the venomous snakes, that it has been hypothesized that if we have some kind of hardwired instinctual reaction to snakes, it was mainly about children.
Right.
Right. That there would be small children would be vulnerable to them.
Right. And of course, that's going to be the case with a lot of predators in general. Mm. You know, the wild cat that is not a danger to an adult human could be a danger to a small child. I mean, definitely that's the case even with modern day crocodilians.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but there are definitely crocodilians that are a danger to adults.
Yes, yes, but even, you know, more so to a diminutive human.
Yeah. Well, I'd just like to wrap up today by saying I'm on Thulsa Doom's side. I would join his cult. I would take his side against Conan and his evil friends. And yeah. There's where my loyalty is.
Okay. Even though, just to be clear, they do practice cannibalism. That's firmly established.
You know, it
big
was a little cannibalism
stews
here and there. Hang out with Sven Ole Thorsen, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There does seem to be a certain amount of just hanging out and chilling in the temple set.
Flesh is stronger than steel.
That's right. That's what he tells us. All right. So there you have it. Again, we set out to do one episode. We had to break this one into two, but I think it was worthwhile because we got to explore a few things that I don't think we would have necessarily ever covered on the show had we not been prompted by Thulsa Doom's teachings. Likewise, we got to highlight some areas we might come back to in the future related to the study of serpents.
Yeah, totally. I'm not done. This is not just another snake cult. We will be the snake religion by the time we're finished.
All right. Well, in the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you want to check out those past movie episodes that we've done, Highlander 2, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Dark Crystal, you can find them all at stufftoblowyourmind.com. And if you want to support the show, the best thing you can do is rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. You know, wherever you get this podcast, give us some stars, leave a nice comment. That helps us out. Also, if you haven't checked out Invention, check out Invention. It's the other podcast that we do. It is an invention-by-invention exploration of human techno-history. We've been looking a lot at photography and motion picture. So, you know, if you perhaps you check this episode out because you're into films and you're like, what kind of science are they going to squeeze out of this this puppy? Well, then go check out Invention and learn about where the technology of films came from.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
You've probably heard a lot about electrified vehicles lately. Well, Toyota has electrified options for every lifestyle. We've got hybrids, no plug needed.
All right, let's go.
But we also have plug-in hybrids, if that's your thing. You can even go 100% electric in the Toyota bZ4X. With so many options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified, diversified. Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.